The Guardian.
Hi, I'm Jim Falzerano, and this is The Guardian Weekly Podcast for August 27th, 2008, bringing you news and analysis from around the world. This week, NATO gets bogged down in Afghanistan.
NATO will have to be there for a long time to keep this government afloat.
The Democrats finally get their act together.
Here again, we have a young, fresh-faced candidate for president who can do great things and bring back that spirit of optimism.
And Catherine Whitehorn on cooking in a bedsitter.
We thought Greek food was amazingly exotic. Anything that required an aubergine needed explaining.
A recent surge by Taliban forces in Afghanistan has led to the deaths of more than 100 people in a week and has underscored the difficulty of NATO's mission in that fractured country. I asked The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Julian Borger, whether the West was engaged in a hopeless battle.
Well, first of all, it underestimated the task in hand, particularly the British, who only sent 3,000 troops into Helmand. They now got 8,000 and are still struggling. They thought the Taliban was defeated. It wasn't defeated. It was recouping on the Afghan-Pakistan border and has been able to come back into the south and east, exploiting the weakness of the central government and the misjudgment of NATO, which only sent relatively small amounts of troops considering the job in hand, and is split over sending in combat troops. There are still NATO members who don't want their troops to go into combat in Afghanistan, and is exerting real strains on the alliance.
Now, you talked about the weakness of the Afghan government. To what extent is this a vital factor? Because, as you know, in some areas, the Taliban have set up shop. They've become the de facto administration, having courts and being able to solve the kinds of problems that people have to solve. To what extent is this kind of a fundamental weakness?
Well, it's really the key question. You could describe it as the battleground. NATO is there trying to expand the writ of the Karzai government beyond Kabul into the south and east, and it's proving very, very difficult. The people on the ground have shown and voiced their support for rule from Kabul and with the support of the coalition forces. But they have to back whoever has power on the ground and have been until now sitting it out, really, waiting to see who can provide those services that you mentioned and who has real power on the ground. And until and unless Kabul can prove that it is calling the shots, and it's a long way from doing so, then people on the ground, from the peasants, the day laborers, to the opium farmers, are going to back the Taliban.
Now, you mentioned the possibility of more troops, but would more troops necessarily solve the problem? Because you could argue that the hearts and minds of the Afghan people are being lost or have been lost.
Well, to the extent that it's clear that Taliban have, in large areas of the country, the upper hand and have shown themselves at least the match to NATO forces, and local people have no option but to hand over tithes from growing opium to them, cooperating with them in the drug trade. The argument made by commanders on the ground is when you can show that you have the military mettle to take on the Taliban, to defeat them, and to push them out, and then to hold the ground that you've taken, then people in the areas will see a long-term future and a more secure future. And as soon as the security situation has improved, it will make more sense for them to grow tomatoes, say, rather than opium, because the opium trade feeds on insecurity.
Aren't we in danger of getting into an Iraq-like situation where we have a central government that's, for all intents and purposes, not existent? And yet the idea is, well, you could bring more troops in and show them who's boss, but unless you keep showing them, unless you essentially occupy this territory, are you going to have any long-term advantage?
Well, there are parallels with Iraq, and one of the central parallels is that the aim is to keep the situation under control until the national security forces have built themselves up to the extent that they can do the job on their own. And in both Afghanistan and Iraq, the army are still quite a way away from achieving that. But nevertheless, in both countries, progress is being made towards that aim. Afghan army troops are being used more and more in critical battles. But it's still clear that NATO will have to be there for a long time to keep this government afloat. And the risks of the Karzai government going down are enormous. The collapse of the country, perhaps the return of the Taliban to Kabul, and you'd be back where you started in 2001.
So does NATO have the stomach for this fight? Do you have a sense that they know what they have to do and are willing to do it?
There's a split between NATO members over how important this fight is. It's clear that the US, France and Britain are determined that this is the fight that they have to win, that this is critical in terms of pushing back al-Qaeda and extreme jihadism, and that it's a battle that has to be won, because if Afghanistan collapses, then the security consequences for the West are unmentionable. But there are still NATO members who do not see it as being in their interests, worth their while, to put troops on the front line, and this is causing real problems within the alliance.
That was Julian Borger. With Barack Obama and John McCain running neck and neck in U.S. polls, the Democrats are staging their national convention in Denver, Colorado. Obama selected Joe Biden, the senator from Delaware, as his vice presidential running mate, and hopes the convention will give his candidacy a bounce toward winning the presidential election on November 4th. The Guardian's U.S. correspondent, Suzanne Goldenberg, and the editor of the Guardian America website, Michael Tomasky, report from the convention.
Well, this convention is really about jump-starting Barack Obama's campaign for the White House. He's now got his vice president, that's Joe Biden, and together the two of them want to really get this campaign energized. They want to unite the Democratic Party around them, and most importantly, they need to sort of halt the slide in their poll numbers. They need to really come out of here on a high and go and start the last sort of weeks of the campaign.
I'm Michael Tomasky, editor of Guardian America. The nominee's speech is the opportunity for him to state his biography, state his rationale for being president, talk about his vision for the country in his highest profile, by far, platform that he'll have.
This is crucial if Barack Obama is going to get this campaign off to a flying start. First of all, he needs to come out of Denver with a clear message of what he stands for and what he and the Democrats can do for the country if he is elected president. Barack Obama also needs to convince Democrats, his own party people, to support him. Crucially, he has to win over disgruntled supporters of Hillary Clinton. He has to show that he takes her seriously, that he respects her, and that he will carry forward some of the ideas that she stood for. Those are the two main challenges here. He has to show what he stands for, and he has to bring the party behind him.
The Clintons loom very large here. Some 20 to 25% of Hillary Clinton's voters say they're going to vote for John McCain. That's a huge number. It's not a number that Barack Obama can really live with or win with, I don't think. So he's got to get that whittled down to a more reasonable 5, 6, 7%. There's a lot of guessing about whether the Clintons really will enthusiastically endorse Obama and campaign for him and speak well of him and urge her supporters to vote for him. The more cynical people even suspect that she wants him to lose so that she can run again in 2012. And these are very real concerns. And I think Bill Clinton, just on a personal level, seems to really dislike Barack Obama. And seems, you know, to be worried that, you know, Obama's gonna steal his thunder and that, you know, he'll no longer be the great rock star of the Democratic Party.
There is really a sense of history to this convention in all sorts of aspects. For one, you've got to consider the location. Denver has not been the site for a Democratic convention in exactly a century. So by hosting it here, the Democrats really want to show that they're serious about winning the election in the West. Barack Obama's targeting Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada. The Democrats really see that this year the road to the White House is through the West. So that's one aspect of history. You know, there's all sorts of echoes here in Barack Obama's candidacy to JFK. He's consciously trying to use those images and to sort of make people feel that here again, there we have a young, fresh-faced candidate for president who can do great things and bring back that spirit of optimism. terrorism. At the same time, you know, the Democrats are also trying to look back to the 1990s when Bill Clinton was in power and to sort of draw a contrast between that era of economic prosperity in the last 8 years under George Bush.
That was Suzanne Goldenberg and Michael Tomasky. Joining me now is David Motes of the Rutland Herald in Rutland, Vermont, who helped handicap the political field for us at the beginning of the U.S. primary season. I asked him whether Barack Obama's relative unfamiliarity to most Americans gives the Republicans carte blanche to paint an unflattering portrait of the Democratic candidate.
Their strategy, the strategy of Karl Rove, Bush's former advisor, has always been to attack the person where he is strong. So for John Kerry, he was a war hero, so they attacked him and created questions about the validity of that. Totally bogus, but with Obama, he's very popular. He draws huge crowds, and so they have attacked that. They somehow tried to use that against him as if he's just a celebrity like Paris Hilton or Britney Spears. So to the extent that he is unknown, they can create questions, and that's what they're trying to do.
Now, at The Guardian, Obama's trip to Europe was covered with great interest, if not adulation. How does that sit with your average American?
Well, I guess there's two ways that a person could react. On one level, you could be suspicious of his ability to wow people. You know, that puts some people on their guard. Even when I saw him in New Hampshire during the primary, you know, he was very good. But the person sitting next to me, a media person, said, yeah, where's the beef? And so that's there. But then again, the trip to Europe, he sort of cast him as the president in waiting, and it showed a great ability to deal with foreign leaders, to handle these situations. You know, created in the minds of voters, he hopes, the idea he can operate on that stage.
Right, let's talk about the convention this week. What has the selection of Biden done for Obama?
I think that's a great selection. Biden's a regular guy. That's the way he comes across anyway, from a working class Pennsylvania, Catholic, with a lot of experience in Washington and expertise in foreign affairs. All of those things help. He's also a combative campaigner. He can go out there and take on McCain and do it with wit. There's a great contrast between Biden and Dick Cheney, who he hopes to succeed. Dick Cheney is very secretive and closed-mouthed. Biden has, if anything, a mouth that won't stop, you know, and the opposite of secretive.
To what extent is the race issue a factor in the fact that this is such a tight race?
It's there, you know, there's a certain segment of the population that will never vote for a black man, you know, they maybe wouldn't have voted for a Democrat anyway, and it's part of the uncertainty factor, and it also is a delicate issue for both candidates to maneuver around without coming across as either racist or playing the race card, you know, both of them have to maneuver carefully around it.
That was David Motes. Given the recent political turmoil in Pakistan, the resignation of the controversial Pervez Musharraf as president must have seemed like a hopeful sign to many people. But now the coalition government has collapsed, reviving the prospect of more instability. The Guardian's Pakistan correspondent, Saeed Shah, reports.
It seems that the coalition was just being held together by their sort of common enemy, which was President Pervez Musharraf. And having got together to oust him, they found that they could agree on little else. Particularly keeping them apart was this issue of the judges that were fired by Musharraf, about 60 judges, back in November. And Nawaz Sharif, one of the two partners in the coalition, he wanted those judges back. Asif Zardari, the chairman of the Pakistan People's Party, was adamant that the former Chief Justice wouldn't come back. They just couldn't agree on this point. And Nawaz Sharif basically stormed out on Monday.
And what is the cause of the disagreement? Is this a judicial matter, a political matter? Why couldn't they?
Well, on the face of it, it's a judicial matter, but underlying it all is politics. Each is trying to get a political advantage over the other. For Nawaz Sharif, bringing back the judges, he thought would help him politically. He would get the credit for it. And possibly these judges would make life difficult for Asif Zardari, who's had a lot of criminal cases registered against him over the years. They've currently been dropped. But the fear is, as far as Zardari is concerned, is if these judges come back, they may start to mess with that. And these criminal charges might reappear.
Now, what about the idea of redesigning the president's role? How is that a factor in this?
Well, they complain that Pakistan is supposed to be a parliamentary system of government. And when Musharraf was in power as president, he basically ran the show. So what they decided beforehand was that once they get rid of Musharraf, they'd cut the presidential powers, and Pakistan would return to the parliamentary system, which is envisaged in its constitution. However, with Asif Zardari there, A, it was not clear whether the presidential powers would be cut. And secondly, even if they are, he's such a domineering figure that effectively everything will be run from the presidency. So the prime minister will be as irrelevant as he was under Musharraf, and politics and political intrigue will continue to gather around the presidency.
Is this just a case of the lure of power being just too strong for reform?
It can be reform, but it requires will. And the other issue is, what is the reality on the ground? Zardari is head of the Pakistan People's Party, which is the biggest party in the government, in the coalition government. And within that, he's a very powerful figure. So if he becomes president as well, then he will have all power to himself. This is a prospect that certainly worries Nawaz Sharif and worries other people in Pakistan.
Pervez Musharraf, whatever his faults, he was regarded, at least by some in the West, as a pivotal figure in the quote-unquote war against terror. Now that he's gone, how does this affect Pakistan's role in this wider geopolitical struggle?
Well, I don't think Pakistan's role in the war on terror will change an awful lot. I mean, it's essentially decided by the Pakistan Army. I mean, it's under new leadership, but the Pakistan Army's view on these things is kind of permanent. They have an outlook on the war on terror, which requires them to cooperate to some extent with America and not cooperate to some degree. They perceive their own interests being not quite aligned with those of America. So that will continue, and any Pakistani leader really has to carry on with the Americans and its Western allies because they provide an awful lot of funding. They are in charge of debt relief and all these things, and they really can't afford to be isolated. So the war on terror, I think, will be pretty much unaffected by this.
Explain to us what the role of the Pakistani army is in the turmoil in Afghanistan.
The NATO and American forces in Afghanistan are relying on the Pakistan army to keep the Pakistan's tribal border region under control, because this is used by militants who stage attacks in Afghanistan, then they retreat back to Pakistan. It's also used as a base by al-Qaeda. Now, the complaint by NATO is that the Pakistan army is not really playing fair here, and while they are acting against some of these militant groups, they're leaving others alone. And it's a kind of double game being played by the Pakistan army, because essentially, Pakistan does not want to see an Afghanistan that is closely allied to America and closely allied to India, because it doesn't believe it's in its strategic interests. So they will do what they can to make sure that the Karzai government is not stable. This is a huge problem for the West.
Is it even possible for the Pakistani army, let's assume for the sake of argument that they wanted a stable Afghanistan, would it be possible for them to control their border region?
Well, it would require a huge commitment of resources and will. I mean, it's very difficult terrain. It's ruled under tribal custom. You know, the Pakistan army is regarded as alien in the tribal area as an American army or any other country's army. The Pakistan army has never been in the tribal region before 9/11. It went in afterwards. It's not liked, and it's very hostile and difficult terrain to operate in. So, yes, they could do more than they are doing currently, but they're never going to completely address the issue because, you know, it's a very difficult area to operate in.
Saeed Shah's story on Pakistan is published in the print edition of The Guardian Weekly. Also in this week's edition, Dan McDougall visits the gypsy camps in Italy as they mourn two girls who were drowned on a beach near Naples. Their bodies were left lying on the beach as ordinary life continued around them. He meets the grandmother of the two dead girls, who keeps hoping that the younger generation of Roma will find a place in Italian society. With our sister paper Le Monde, we meet a growing army of French bird watchers. The League for the Protection of Birds had only 3,000 members in 1993, but that's now grown to 46,000. Then we travel to India to meet Indians who are finding themselves the first generation caught in the trap of rising debt. For the middle classes, this means treats such as dining out and going to the movies are having to be cut back. For the poor, the effects are much more serious. I'm Jim Falzerano, and you're listening to Guardian Weekly. Coming up, Team GB finishes fourth in Beijing. And Catherine Whitehorn asks, what's for dinner? The Beijing Olympics was a big success for the next Olympic host, Great Britain, which tallied 47 medals, putting them in fourth place. The Guardian's James Dart reviews the results.
I think the biggest surprise for a lot of British followers would have been Rebecca Adlington in the swimming, her two golds and one world record. I don't think lots of people sort of picked her out in the build-up to the Games. A lot of people expected great things from the cyclists, and they duly produced, and Christine Ohorogu as well. But when it came to the pool and finally getting some British gold in there, it was a bit of a shock for a lot of people, and she performed fantastically. I think you'll find this in the next 4 years, that this achievement of a finishing fourth is going to spark more expectation, higher performance delivery, that people will expect that far more medals come London.
And now, let's forget about Team GB for a moment. Let's just look at the big picture. What really impressed you with these Olympics?
Well, you can't go past the likes of Usain Bolt and Michael Phelps. They're the sort of the standout achievements that I think most people will say, but they're a little bit boring to mention them. I'd like to look beyond that. I think Kenenisa Bekele in the 5,000 metres, 10,000 metres in the men's event, doubling up there was a phenomenal achievement and somewhat overshadowed, I think, by world records and stuff from the likes of Bolt. For me, one of my favourite stories was Matthias Steiner, German weightlifter. He won gold in the 105 kilograms and above weightlifting category in the wake of his wife dying in a car crash in the year before. He'd recently taken over, assumed a German nationality to marry his wife, and he broke down in incredible tears and jubilation at the end of it, in great emotion. And he had a photograph of her on the podium. It was a very emotional occasion, and it was a great highlight for me, I think. And there are far more interesting stories all the way around the Olympics when you look close enough. The Togolese kayaker winning his country's first ever medal, and the scenes of him sort of smashing it and breaking his paddle in half to celebrate. It was great, and it was almost better than I think the sort of the medals for Great Britain at the time. And I think this really sort of epitomises what the Games is all about. And without trying to sort of patronise them, there are some of the things that really remain etched in our memory.
He'll never buy another drink.
Too right.
All right, finally, looking forward 4 more years to London 2012. Do you think you'll be able to put on as good a show?
I think it's interesting that a lot of the higher members, the likes of Lord Coe and such, are sort of saying that Beijing on the scale and the extravagance, it's unlikely to be repeated again come 2012, which sounds a little bit negative, but I think this was a very much a unique kind of Games. It was you're not going to see the kind of sort of political pressure that was imparted upon the Games of a nation almost having to bow down and take second place for the Games. London will be slightly smaller scale. It will be unique to London. Let's hope it's a little bit more impressive than the handover ceremony featuring Boris Johnson was on the Sunday afternoon.
Thank you, James Dart. In 1961, Catherine Whitehorn wrote Cooking in a Bedsitter, a book that gave young professionals a guide to urban survival and introduced a fresh new voice to the world of journalism. Now that her work has been reissued for a new generation, I asked her whether she set out to write, in the words of one reviewer, a, quote, practical contribution to women's freedom.
No, I didn't see it that way particularly, because I think actually at that time, young men who started their working lives in a bedsitter just as much. I think it was much more a question that everybody assumed that you started to cook as a bride, a housewife, and you had a proper kitchen. And actually, for the youngsters getting into their first jobs or college situations, that was exactly what they didn't have. They had a popping gas ring and water at the end of the corridor, and usually it was the bathroom, and somebody would be singing arias in the bath when you wanted to fill the kettle. And it had a marvellous secondary market of, well, first of all, old people who knew how to cook all right, but they didn't know their quantities in ones if they went into, you know, sheltered housing. But one time we were invited by a club that had the Admiral in charge of Portsmouth as one of its members, a dining club. And my husband, Gavin Lyle, who was very interested in military things, was expecting to discuss battles with these senior seamen, and was stunned when a couple of gnarled old sea dogs with gold braid out yard across their shoulders came up and thanked me for saving their lives. And I said, but I've never been to sea. And they said, no, but when we're sent on a course, we're given a saucepan and a spoon and a copy of your book, without which we would have starved.
Excellent. All right, now let's talk about English food. The presumption, I suppose, is that in those days you didn't have the resources that you do now in terms of cooking and whatnot. Has the English food, the improvement in food available and so on, how has that changed the equation?
Well, I think it's changed it completely, because before the war, housewives aimed to have a roast, and everything was meat and two veg, whatever it was, and the only instant food you ever got was fish and chips. And then the housewives had a struggle through the war, and the time when I was sort of coming on the stream in the 50s, we were gradually getting new foods and getting things back. But, you know, we thought Greek food was amazingly exotic. anything that required an aubergine needed explaining, this kind of thing. Two things that have changed enormously. One is, of course, the way we shop, supermarkets and so on, and everything is prepackaged. I mean, in those days, you had to confront an actual butcher and try and identify these awful red bits on the slab. One completely forgets that poorish people wouldn't have had a fridge until at least the beginning of the 60s. And so you had to eat everything up or turn it into some, rissoles, mince, things like that. The reason we've reissued this thing as a retro joke is that the food scene has changed so completely nowadays that one couldn't really bring that book up to date. Now it's the world of instant food, supermarkets, worldwide food, everything available all the year round.
Let's talk about your Observer column. First of all, explain how you came to write it.
It seems extraordinary now, but it was really one of the very first that a woman was allowed to write that was a serious column and personal, but also about general things. And I think it was very soon taken up. Anne Scott James, who had done a brilliant page in Sunday Express for years, she started doing a similar sort of column in the Mail, and Julie Cooper did a much funnier one in the Sunday Times. And now, of course, there are these personal columns all over everywhere. And I think that they're very valuable when they've got a point to make. They're pretty boring unless they're funny, if it's just, cooer, look at me in my wet dustbin.
So when did you begin to suspect that your column was having a real impact on women and the way that they thought of their lives?
Well, it was one particular article I wrote. You have to remember that women's pages were always a bit prissy, and they were always, magazines were trying to persuade women to be perfect, perfect cooks and perfectly dressed and so on. And I wrote an article about how rotten it was if you were a slut and your little white collars were never white and you had to go around with a black felt pen to, quote, mend, close quote, your black tights when there was a hole in them and that kind of stuff. And I've never known such a response as I had to that article. It was as if they felt free to say, yes, it's all frightful and we're struggling and we don't always get it right. And they wrote in with, one woman said, yes, she find herself wiping the table with the kitten and that kind of thing.
So you really tapped into the zeitgeist there.
Apparently, yes.
Very good. Catherine Whitehorn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. This podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Jim Falzerano. John Dennis will be back next week.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.